Just doing a quick mic check.
Testing. Who did the mic check?
This is Paul Brigner.
Paul?
This is Paul.
Perfect, perfect. Meredith, see there. Do you want to do a mic check, Meredith?
Yeah. Can you guys hear me okay?
Yes, perfect. Hang on. We have Carter joining.
Testing, testing.
Perfect. Right, we have Patrick from Oasis joined. Just waiting for two more. We have mobile coin on as well. Stuck. Could you do a mic check, please? Mobile coin, are you there? Hi, Stark. Yes, we can hear you. All right. I think we're still waiting for Orchid. All right, let's kick off. We hope that Orchid will join us shortly. And I know that Nim will be joining in at the 30-minute mark. So let's kick off. Great. Welcome, everybody, to the UPA XSpace Global Encryption Day special. So just a quick background on what Global Encryption Day is. It's actually on the 21st of October, which is actually a Saturday. So we're just doing this space a little bit earlier during the week so that we could engage as much people as possible. And... So, sorry, I'm just adding Orchid right now as a speaker. All right, Orchid should be on really shortly. Right, so as I was saying, it's actually on the 21st of October, this Saturday. We're doing it this week to engage as much people as possible. Global Encryption Day is actually something that was created by the Global Encryption Coalition. It is a day of action where they hope that civil society, businesses, technologies, and internet users across the world will come together to promote and protect and defend strong encryption. So this may seem a little bit strange, especially for those who are on the user side of things. Why is it that we need to defend strong encryption? Well, basically, there's been a bit of a debate around encryption in terms of balancing the need for national security with the right to privacy, since, you know, encryption has become a really critical part of our digital lives in recent times. And today, this specific space is actually organized by UPA, which is the Universal Privacy Alliance, which is made up of a lot of different privacy preserving projects, which are currently only in Web3, but we also hope to include Web2 projects in the near future. These projects are all cross-stack and cross-chain, so it is a very good example of how, you know, projects and stakeholders with the same vision can come together and actually get things done. So I'm just going to do a quick round of introduction to the speakers of today. If I call your name, please state your project and your name and perhaps just your role. So we'll start off with Orchid.
Hi, thank you. Yeah, this is Travis Cannell. I'm the head of product for Orchid.
Great. Next, I think on my screen we have MobileCoin.
Hey, yep, my name is Stark Radazel. I'm the head of security at MobileCoin.
Next, we have Carter, I think, representative of Secret Network.
Yep, Carter at Secret Network. I'm a researcher and builder over at Secret.
We have Paul next.
Hi, everyone. This is Paul Brigner. I'm head of U.S. policy and strategic advocacy at the Electric Coin Company. Thanks for organizing this.
I think Meredith, you're next.
Hey, everyone. I'm Meredith Darden, and I'm a developer advocate at Aztec.
Patrick.
Hello, everyone. Great to be here with you guys. I'm Patrick Degenhardt, head of marketing community at Oasis.
Great. And as mentioned, NIM Project will join us on the 30-minute mark. Jaya Brekke from the CSO will join us shortly. So let's kick off. I'm going to do a quick deep dive into actually, you know, diving into what actually encryption's role is. So what is encryption's role in true privacy in our lives? The same companies that use it are the ones that are collecting data, giving us a bit of a false sense of security. So how can they actually do better? Maybe Orchid would like to kick off with that.
Yeah, I think how we can do better. I mean, I think we can build our own apps and products to not track, to not save user data. Really try to build stuff from the bottom up with privacy in mind. It can be challenging from a marketing and product perspective to not store data and not see how data is, you know, how users are using your app. But I think that, you know, ultimately it's a lot of it can boil down to how you build.
Great. Carter, do you have anything to say about that, perhaps?
Yeah, I mean, encryption undergirds everything in Web2, from credit card transactions to online banking to filing taxes. It's it's absolutely the basis for everything we do, the protection of information. But what Web3 has, it has this unique opportunity to migrate away from central points of failures, these companies like Amazon, Microsoft, and Google, and instead have a true peer-to-peer economy where it's individuals owning their own data. It's kind of empowering the sovereignty and the individual liberties. So blockchain and cryptography are incredibly disruptive forces for good. And it's on us to really push the technology and help educate people on the differences between how cryptography is used in Web 2 and what the opportunity is in Web 3.
Yeah, you see, you mentioned that, you know, encryption actually touches, it's actually across a lot of touch points in our digital lives, like from credit card transactions and so on. If I'm not wrong, encryption actually is very instrumental in, well, you know, e-commerce is how we know it today, right? And also encryption actually, you know, one huge argument about the debate is that it actually also keeps digital communications safe. Is this something that is a bit of a given then that, you know, as a user, if I see that encryption is being used in, say, certain websites that I'm on, I should just assume that I'm actually really safe?
That's an interesting question. I think as time has gone on, more and more users in Web2 realize it's safe in quotations. Like, data collection has become kind of the norm, unfortunately. And I think we have the opportunity to have users realize that we don't have to exist in a paradigm where these massive centralized servers and centralized forces have a lot of control. We can actually do better than the existing paradigm. So yeah, I don't think we should assume safety. There's some forms of safety, but ultimately centralization exposes users.
Right. So I think working in the privacy space, a lot of us, you know, talk about privacy versus security, or privacy equals security, and so on and so forth. It's a bit confusing for a lot of users, and even those in the tech space. So let's go a little bit into, you know, the security and privacy itself. So how can companies actually operate with a security first mindset by enabling better privacy practices, I guess, within their own platforms? Stark, maybe you want to take this question.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think you made a strong point there, talking about the difference between security and privacy. It can get muddied, especially if your day-to-day isn't thinking about these problems all the time. In my mind, I think that privacy gives better security to our users, insofar as if I have less data about our users, then there's less data to be stolen by bad actors or to be compromised in a hack or anything like that, right? Like, you know, we talk about your keys, your crypto, right? But that really only comes from the fact that if you keep your keys secure, then you keep your money secure. And if you're going to trust a third party to do that for you, you're giving up that privacy, you're giving up that access to data, in expectation that they're going to provide security for you. For some people that might make sense, for others it might not. But if you're going to operate either, you know, a service that is custodial or non-custodial, like MobileCoin, our Mobi app is non-custodial. Whenever we build these services, we have to think about what is all the metadata we're collecting incidentally, stuff that we can't really prevent ourselves from collecting, and build privacy into that so that we don't have to think quite as hard about what happens if we get hacked or what happens if there's a subpoena drawn against us or what happens if, you know, if we just decide one day to do something differently, we're kind of prevented in that because we built our protocol in a way where we collect the minimum amount of data required. And I think if more institutions, both centralized institutions and decentralized institutions, operate with this kind of restricted mindset where we collect as little data as possible just to get the business done. It gets us into that mindset of having better security just by fact of having less attack surface.
That's really interesting. I'm just wondering if any of the other protocols would like to chime in. I mean, given that there's a whole wide range of use cases that's actually using your protocols, maybe Aztec or Oasis, perhaps.
Yeah, actually, I don't have a ton to add from the corporate side of things of what we can do, but I definitely agree with everything that Stark just said.
Great. Well, then, Meredith, what steps? Okay, so we've looked at what companies can actually do. What about individuals? What steps can individuals take to actually combat, you know, this surveillance culture and actually advocate for their individual right to privacy, if they are actually, you know, using platforms that they know are not sufficient for their privacy needs, but they, you know, for some reason or the other, they need to stick to using those platforms.
Yeah, and that's something that I'm obviously pretty passionate about. But yeah, like when it comes to these encryption backdoors that we're seeing different entities and nations advocate for, like those generally do not benefit individuals. And like, in fact, it just basically undermines privacy and security of like all of our digital communications and puts us at huge risk. So from an individual perspective, I think the first thing is that people have to learn about their privacy, how to protect their privacy, a little bit about encryption. I'm not saying that individuals have to be cryptographers, but just more so the bigger picture of the implications of living in a surveillance culture and society. And then, you know, like Stark was just saying, from organizations, them not collecting data is great. But as an individual, like we can use all of these tools that are laid out in front of us. So that would be like privacy-focused browsers, search engines, decentralized technology, private messaging apps, and then like take that education and take those tools and like get as many people around you to use them as possible. I also think that like supporting organizations that advocate for digital privacy and also using open source software is really important in this. And then like just going back to like who you choose to do business with as an individual, if you see these like companies that are not handling data and user privacy the right way, like just, you know, kind of take this strong stance and say, I'm not going to use that, and actively even advocate against them. So like, that's just a few ways I think that individuals can, you know, push back on encryption backdoors.
Well, this is interesting. I know, you know, a lot of people like to say that, oh, you know, people don't care about privacy. And then I've said it many times, actually, people don't know how to care about privacy. I think one vision that the UPA has is actually to make sure that there is enough awareness and that people can make informed decisions. You know, we have about 6-7 projects from the UPA that's on this call. I'm interested, you know, this is going to be an open question to everyone, like your community, like, how long did it take for them to actually, you know, get into to be such a deep part of the communities? You also have really, really strong communities, and they seem to know what's going on, and they seem to be, you know, like huge privacy advocates. Like, did you think that it was really difficult to get to onboard them into, you know, this privacy first, privacy is normal, privacy, you know, by default sort of mindset? And do you think that they are well equipped enough to actually know how to you know, make sure that their privacy rights are actually protected? This is an open question to, you know, anybody, you know, community managers or maybe, you know, developer relation advocates.
If I may take this one, in terms of the Oasis community, I think the Oasis community is extremely passionate about privacy. And the funny thing about privacy is that when it's one of those things that you value most when you lose it, right? So when you see your data being hacked and floating around on the internet, being used by, you know, potential malevolent acts, that's when you value the most, and you wish that you had protected it in the best way possible. So the funny thing about community is that we are extremely strong in countries where there is a deficit in terms of privacy, you know, where the democratic workings of society are not as strong as in, you know, countries like the US or the UK or the European Union. And we see a lot of people interested in this from countries that are suffering from almost dictatorial regimes. So, yeah, as a result, you see that there's more value when people effectively see this as one of the key pillars of their democracy, essentially.
Does anyone else want to chime in there?
Yeah, I can speak a little bit for ORCID. I think on the community side, we've just been a big advocate on Twitter for many years and generated a lot of community and interest and enthusiasm around privacy that way. To the degree that we do see data from Google and Apple, because we do have published apps in those stores that have, unfortunately, you know, some tracking through their systems. We do see spikes in conflict regions in our VPN app usage when different conflicts have broken out over the world over the last couple of years. And so I think that our community and users really do take it seriously, and it is vital for them to get information, to get to share information, and to organize and find out what's going on. But our community really obviously takes it seriously.
So I'm going to, let's stick on the topic of communities and users. I think a lot of us here are Web3 projects that are, you know, we have this whole big thing about, you know, having mainstream adoption to our services and our projects. And, you know, one thing that is a recurring theme in both Web3 and even Web2, you know, traditional sort of businesses, is that we want to make sure that, you know, the user experience is actually on point. We want to make sure that users find it easy to actually, you know, get what they need when they're using our services, when they're on our platforms, whether it's digital communications, whether it's, you know, purchasing something, whether it's just, you know, like data storage, right? So obviously, you know, this whole surveillance capitalism idea started with, you know, our favorite tech company, Google, right? In fact, you know, I think encryption was set by default in, you know, Google, and actually I think Apple's devices back, I want to say maybe 2012 or 2014, I don't know. So this comes to my next question, right? In order to actually make sure that what we provide to users are what they need and what they want, we need information and data on them. How do we look at the compromise on user privacy in our own projects, you know, through the use of, say, trackers, you know, both in our apps or your websites for UX improvement? And, you know, what are the trade-offs there, if any, should we consider? Maybe Travis can continue on, then we move on to another project as well.
Yeah, I mean, I think wallet design could use some improvement for better onboarding. That's certainly at work when we're trying to bring people on, people that might not necessarily know about Web3 are looking to get the benefit of decentralization. That's just one thing I'd point out, but I'm curious to hear from other teams.
Well, I'm interested to hear from maybe Paul and maybe Mobile Coin after, because you both actually have privacy coins, right? And then this means there's wallets, there's also different things. I know that you don't actually collect data, but how do you know like what you're designing, what you're building is actually meeting the needs of your users? Maybe Paul, you can start.
I can give it a try. You know, I think for us, a lot of it is just making sure that there's always consent by the user. And I think, as you point out, for the most part, we're not collecting anything. So it's not so much of an issue that we have to deal with. However, we are working on a wallet that I think there's a beta out now, actually. So I'm not, of course, on the engineering side of things. And I don't know if what they're doing to ensure that the user privacy is maintained throughout that tool as well. But yeah, from my perspective, it's helping users just have that choice, and you know, always going back to consent and helping users to be hopefully more strategic about their privacy. I think that is an issue I often see, is that in organizations and companies, whenever they make decisions, they think about the long term, and individuals just often don't. You know, they are much more likely to make a short term trade off, and as was said earlier, once the privacy is lost, that's when you want it back. You want it most, and you can't get it back. It's just too late. It's gone. So, yeah, hopefully just giving that option for consent and encouraging strategic behavior.
Yeah, and I can add on to that from MobileCoin's perspective. So I work as the head of security, so this is kind of a core question that I ask a lot, which is, how can we minimize what we're collecting about the users of our app and still be able to make strategic decisions about product design, marketing success, things like that? Because at the end of the day, right, we have an app that we want people to use. And if people don't like it or they're having problems with it, we want to be able to help them. So like even simple stuff like a user asks us, hey, you know, I did a transaction, but like something went wrong. In a traditional like Web 2 or like e-commerce sense, I would just open up the portal on, you know, our internal site and just look to see the transaction, see what went wrong. But for us, we have to spend a lot of time asking questions because we have such little visibility into what's going on, both on the network and inside the app that we build. The app's not as private as the network because it can't be. You know, it has to talk to cloud services because that's just how modern app development is done. But we can minimize that data. It makes the onus on us to build new capabilities around our anonymous visibility. So we don't know anything about the user, but we can collect some anonymous metrics. But then once we have an actual user who's having a problem, like walking them through, building the tools for them to voluntarily provide data to us instead of us pulling it from their records is something that we built into the app, for example. There are a lot of trade-offs here, but we've been operating under the principle of kind of minimum data required to do the business.
Carter, I think Secret Network has quite a large ecosystem of different use cases. So obviously, you know, with different privacy needs, do you have anything to add on to this? Maybe in your role as a researcher, you know, how much of consideration do you take in terms of the privacy protection that actually Secret Network uses versus what the different users need?
For sure. Yeah. So from Secret Network perspective, we have a lot of DeFi use cases that have launched the last couple of years. Secret Network as a whole just has a wonderful developer community. And kind of on that last question, it is a trade-off, right? If you're not able to see data, it's harder to make data-driven decisions. And so I think the way you can compensate for that is being hyper engaged with your community. People are willing to raise their hand and give direct feedback. So I think from a product perspective, the onus is on the builders to not build in a silo. And even more than maybe Web2 companies, that community engagement is so, so important for privacy projects. Because, you don't have a database and a dashboard to see how many people clicked on this, how many people clicked on this. It's much more about directly engaging the users?
So I mentioned, you know, big tech, Google, Apple, and the likes. I think, you know, just going back to, you know, encryption itself, I think back in the 90s, if I'm not wrong, somebody correct me if I'm wrong, the US government actually tried to ban cryptography, you know, because, you know, it would threaten national security, obviously something that we understand why and we're well aware of. You know, I think one of the biggest thing that they all say is just like, oh, it makes it easier for criminals to actually hide like illegal acts online and so on and so forth. So I think to this day where, you know, Google and Apple actually and other big tech actually set encryption by default in their devices. Obviously, there's been, you know, some sort of discussion and a bit of a compromise there. A lot of that actually also comes down to taking responsibility and also, you know, doing the necessary research whilst you being able to innovate for the users. I know we're all Web3 projects and, you know, big tech is sometimes, you know, we say that's the enemy and whatsoever, but I think there's a lot of things that we can learn because they've been there longer. Is there any sort of like learning points or, you know, how can big tech actually guarantee responsible research and innovation for the apps, whether across social media, you know, e-commerce, and now, you know, the use of AI across different aspects, you know, is there anything that we can learn? Do you think they've done a good job being responsible or how can they be better? Maybe Patrick wants to start off.
Yes, I definitely think that they can do better for sure. And as a result, I think big tech is being targeted by the EU, the UK, Australia, and other countries will also follow suit in terms of creating legislation to try to prevent these issues to occur again. And I think that's only right. I think big tech should work with lawmakers to guarantee the privacy rights of users. In effect, I think big tech should follow our approach in Web3, which is more people-centered, and, you know, in terms of driving forward data ethics above all, instead of profit. And we know that the profits in Web2 are tremendous, really huge. The other point here, I think, is that even the aspect of responsible research and innovation in data science should be using more Web3 technologies. So these big tech companies could be even partnering with Web3, in effect Web 2.5, in order to create better user experiences and better protection in terms of privacy for their users. So things like, for instance, account abstraction for simplified user experience, the protection of users' data using black boxes, for instance, using TEEK technology, Trusted Execution Environments, or ZK technology, for that matter. And that could be extremely helpful for, you know, social media companies, for companies like Alphabet, Microsoft, Apple, and companies working with AI, where you have large swathes of people's data to train these algorithms. And it's very easy to, you know, for this data to get misused. So, and people are not being rewarded for this use either. So these are, I think, ways that big tech could be working with Web3 to try to make things better.
Travis, if I remember correctly, you were on that other side of the barbed wire fence. Based on your past experience and, you know, being in Web3 right now, do you agree, Patrick? Like, is there a chance that big tech could work together with Web3 and is that the best option? Do you think they can do it on their own and be actually better?
I think big tech is built on the premise of basically collecting and using user data for predicting and trying to modify user behavior. And so when that is kind of your core, it's very hard to not fall into a bunch of terrible traps, no matter what you kind of do, because if you start from the premise that your entire business model is predicting what users are going to do and then selling sort of ads around that and collecting all this data. You know, everything that you build is going to be geared for that. So you're going to have AI that is sucking up all that data, and the purpose of that AI is to model user behavior, try to predict user behavior, and then, you know, give those tools to advertisers. So I think the original sin of big tech was building a business model around this kind of user prediction. And you can kind of see it in all of the apps, you know, that are trying to get you sucked back in and staring at the news feed. You know, the original kind of use of AI, and I saw this a lot in ad tech, was, you know, for serving ads, for getting users staying in the apps, staying in these products, getting eyeballs, and then, you know, trying to slightly modify their behavior by serving ads. And when you come from that sort of premise, I think it's hard to then walk that back. I mean, unless they totally change their business model and try to, you know, actually charge people for usage or to send little payments or something, so you don't have to basically sacrifice your this kind of massive collection of user data. But anyways, I think you get the point, but I'll leave it at that.
Great, thanks for your insights. I'm going to shift direction of the space just a little bit to everyone's favorite topic, which is regulation and policy. Yesterday, there was an event organized by PGP, Pretty Good Policy for Crypto Briefing, at the US Capitol Hill. So this event was organized by Electric Coin Co. primarily, alongside Blockchain Association, the Crypto Council for Innovation, and Stand With Crypto. Just a very quick background about what happened. It was a congressional briefing event held at the US Capitol Visitor Center, where there were opening remarks from a few different stakeholders, including a congressman, Tom Emmer, who is a House Majority Whip. A panel was then also hosted, where it included a few of our UPA members, namely Marta Belcher, who is the President and Chair of Filecoin Foundation, Henry Holtzman, CTO of MobileCoin, as well as Zuko, who's the CEO of Electric Coin Co. I think, Paul, you were there on the ground, very instrumental in bringing this together and also, you know, providing pretty good pizza for the attendees. Do you want to give us a quick lowdown about what happened, how it went, and the takeaways from it?
You bet. Thank you. Yeah, you know, I have been working on this for a while now. This is the second year in a row that I've tried to bring Global Encryption Day to the attention of policymakers. Last year, it was not on the Capitol, so I really was happy that we were able to do this in the U.S. Capitol Visitor Center, which is, of course, right there connected to the Capitol, and actually have a very influential member of Congress, Representative Tom Emmer, he's the House Majority Whip, speak to us. And, you know, it's as the organizer, it's kind of hard for me to give you a play-by-play rundown because I was a little bit distracted trying to keep everything moving along. But I would say that that we've got great video of everything. As it turned out, we had a vote for the House Speaker right in the middle of this event. And of course, you cannot plan for these things. So that did affect us a little bit, and it actually affected the timing of Whip Emmer's talk, his opening remarks, and it couldn't be as part of the live stream, but I have sent that out separately, and hopefully you'll find that on a tweet or something that I put out where you can see his remarks as well. So, and I think that was probably, for me, the highlight of the event, just hearing how passionate one of the most senior congressmen in the U.S. Capitol, in Congress, is about crypto. And I mean, he is a true champion, so that gives me hope. Of course, we have many detractors in Congress as well. But the overall, I think just the event was outstanding. I think you'll find a lot of really good insights and discussion there if you can take the time to watch the videos. In addition to that, I in preparation for the event, I did a podcast with Ryan Polk. He's the director of Internet Policy at the Internet Society. And Internet Society is one of the organizations that is kind of on the steering committee of the Global Encryption Coalition. And they drive a lot of this activity around the world. And he went into a lot of the specific details of policy proposals in the U.S., and we touched on some in other parts of the world as well, that I think it's really important for people to be aware of. There's other organizations that have been working hard on this for a long time. Fight for the Future comes to mind. But what I think is really interesting is that there was a reference to back in the 90s when there was the crypto wars, right? And what some people don't know, I think everybody here knows this, but a lot of the policymakers in DC don't know that whenever I talk about PGP, pretty good policy, there's a reference to PGP encryption, the email privacy tool back in the 90s that was really at the, kind of the center of the crypto wars and the work that Phil Zimmerman did back then. So, you know, I try to just make that part of everything that I do and, you know, make it about pretty good policy. And then I play on that with pretty good pizza and pretty good pancakes and other events and pretty good pours most recently. So just trying to, you know, bring all of that together. But where I was going with that is that at that time, there was a flat-out restriction on the export of encryption technologies. And that was really the issue. They were viewed as munitions. And so we don't have that kind of debate today. It's actually a much more nuanced. And what we have today is that there's basically proposals that say for intermediaries, these centralized players, that if you use encryption and you deploy that as part of your services, you may not be taking all the steps you should be legally to protect your users, because you should be moderating this content. You should be checking and making sure that this content does not include child sexual abuse material or other very harmful things. And I know all of us agree that those are terrible things. The question is, do you break encryption and take away everyone's privacy and our national security to allow for moderating that type of content? My answer to that is no. It's not a balance that I think that's not the right balance. That basically is a compromise that we shouldn't be willing to make. So I just encourage you all to take a look at the videos. I hope you really enjoy it, and you know, I'll try to keep pushing for encryption and privacy and you know, working on this in the U.S. Capitol.
I'm going to come back to that last point that you make shortly, because this is something that we're seeing right now here in Europe, in the UK. But just before I touch on that point, one thing that I wanted to bring up is that, so I think Coinbase was also part of the PGP event yesterday, and you know, you mentioned that obviously, you know, there are still some supporters of crypto in the US government, and I think one thing that we have to agree on is that, well, first of all, I mentioned Coinbase because it is one of the very large key players in the crypto industry, and you know, for all of us who are in the crypto industry, we know that, you know, there's been a huge battle against the US government, well, the SEC specifically, with Coinbase. So, you know, Coinbase is large, they have the resources, they have the means, and, you know, they get to try to change the direction of how, you know, crypto is being seen by the US government. However, you know, not every project has the luxury or the privilege to be able to do that. You know, a lot of us are actually, you know, struggling to build, right? And then, you know, regulations come into play, and then, you know, we have to figure out how do we balance basically, you know, the vision and purpose that our projects have and why we got into Web3 in the first place versus what's actually happening in the real world, where, you know, the impact, you know, on actually complying is non-negotiable. So if regulations that are actually difficult for small players to meet are implemented, you know, not because they're not willing, but sometimes it's just really, really difficult, right? And a lot of these regulations don't actually take crypto and Web3 into consideration because the people who are making these regulations are not actually part of the industry, nor believe in the industry. Do you foresee, does anybody foresee, you know, that this will actually impact the growth of cryptocurrency ecosystem in the US? Like, is crypto dead in the US? Like, is it done? Like, do we just leave the US alone and just, you know, let the rest of the world progress? I don't know, maybe Stark, you want to take that question.
Yeah, absolutely. Certainly crypto is not dead in the US today, but I do think there is a risk of that, right? There's always a risk that regulatory capture will happen and regulators will increase the hurdle of entering the regulated cryptocurrency market in the US so much so that it would be unaffordable or inefficient for smaller teams to innovate inside the US borders. We see this a bit in fintech as a whole. There's a lot of fintech regulations and the cost of getting started in fintech is extremely high. And I think in no small part, this is what led to the success of crypto and DeFi in general, is that it lowered the barrier to entry for financial innovation. So, you know, I think as a member of DeFi and as a member of the cryptocurrency community, we're all kind of hoping that we can maintain this velocity of innovation and maintain access to a really important market. And I think that, it's a big danger that if we rely on companies like Coinbase to set the regulatory environment for us, we may be left in a situation where we're kind of priced out of our own market. And that's why I think events like Pretty Good Policy are so important, is to give voices to smaller projects and to get on kind of the good side of policymakers, that we're not the enemy. We're here to help US customers. We don't want anybody to be, on a losing end of any technology. And so we're always, we want to help, like we want to build great products just like everybody else. And I think it's really important.
Any other US-based projects want to chime in on that? Or are you all getting ready to move over to join us here in Europe?
I would say it's absolutely worth the fight. And there's so many young, talented folks coming out of college and university in the US that they don't want to go work for Google. They don't want to go work for Microsoft or Amazon. They want to be part of this decentralized peer-to-peer movement. And a lot of them do value privacy. So I think it's on us to fight as hard as we can to educate the various policymakers. And I think we do have the ability to change the course of history, but it comes with a lot of hard work and sacrifice. And the open source community is very familiar with pulling in the same direction to accomplish really big things. So I think we have a lot to be optimistic about, but freedom, liberty, and privacy, these things are not free, and we have to fight for them.
If I can, maybe I'll just chime in for a second. I do realize that many projects have moved out of the US, and that's been a trend. I personally am very focused on like making the US a place where projects can operate, and I think that we cannot give up on the US at all. I believe that, you know, as a country known for its democratic values and freedom and entrepreneurialism, this is a country where we must thrive. It's honestly not an option. I think it has to happen. It has to be a home for DeFi and crypto just as much as any place else in the world is. So, I'm quite set on continuing the fight here and fighting more than ever.
Yeah, one thing that when I joined, you know, Web3, blockchain, crypto, whatever we all call it, back in 2016, 2017, and one thing that I really loved was it was borderless in terms of the benefits and how we could work and how you could bring the best of the best together to actually advance a project, regardless of where they lived or where they're situated. And it is a bit interesting now to see that, obviously, you know, we can't expect harmonization of regulations and standards worldwide, but it is very interesting to see like the extremes in terms of how the different governments actually view this industry. So I'm going to move on to a more European focus. Like I mentioned, Nim has joined us. So Jaya, the CSO, is now actually in this call.
Hi everyone, sorry I was a little bit delayed. Very good to be here.
That actually reminds me that I never actually introduced myself. I was just so concerned about everybody joining. So I'm actually Candace, and actually I primarily work with Nim, just hosting the UPA Twitter space for today. And it's been great actually working with different privacy projects across chain. So like I said, we're moving on to more European focus. And I mentioned earlier, based off Paul's comments, about, you know, specific content online, like child material and stuff. The UK Online Safety Bill will actually come into law pretty soon. It got signed off, I think, last month. And this has actually raised serious concerns from privacy advocates. Ja, maybe you can take us through it. What is the TLDR of how this is an attack on encryption? And why should we be concerned?
Sure. So yeah, I'm a little bit bummed that I wasn't here earlier to kind of get a little bit more of the what's been discussed so far. The TLDR of the Online Safety Bill, which is a little bit of a repeat of what's happening in Europe, and I believe there's something similar going on in the United States as well, is what a lot of people are calling essentially a kind of a backdoor into end-to-end encryption. So one of the clauses of the bill, which is basically was put in place in order to reduce online harms against children, that was the kind of the mandate, let's say. The intention here is like, can we somehow catch potentially harmful material without breaking privacy, without kind of harming privacy, right? So what they did instead was suggest something called client-side scanning. Client-side scanning, which essentially, instead of looking at your communications in transit, it looks at communications on your devices. So it scans all your pictures for potentially harmful material, and then kind of, you know, flags it, blocks it beforehand. So, you know, it's a kind of like cheeky break of the promise of end-to-end encryption, basically saying nothing is broken in transit, but at the end of the day, compromises privacy and security on everybody's actual devices instead. So it's a kind of new angle in the kind of ongoing waves of mass surveillance that, you know, over the past many years, this is the kind of like latest attempt at a form of mass surveillance. You know, there are still a lot of organizations, both in the UK and in Europe, that are continuing to fight back. So, you know, let's see if we can kind of at least roll back on a few of these issues. But, you know, big companies like WhatsApp and Signal have also, you know, been very vocal against these policies and threatened to withdraw their services from the UK if it actually goes through. So it's an ongoing battle, let's say.
Yeah, I mean, I'm just looking at the press release from the UK government, right? They call this, they said that the bill will actually make the UK the safest place in the world to be online by placing new duties on social media companies.
Which essentially, you know, ironically does the opposite, right? By opening up a back door. I mean, since, you know, over this summer has been very, very interesting for the development of this story, because there's been some very good investigative journalists that have looked into the origins of the Online Safety Bill and its European counterpart, which, you know, does come from, you know, very specific lobbying organizations, where the bill, in fact, is not supported by a lot of actual child safety, third sector organizations and NGOs. So, you know, the darker secrets, the darker kind of origins of these bills are starting to come to light, and hopefully that will have some effect as well. I'll throw some links in the chat if people are interested.
I think we are quite aware, you know, there's been a lot of in different industries, like say, you know, like financial transactions with the issues with SWIFT a couple of years ago, like, you know, a lot of the data in Europe and UK was actually being accessed by the US government. Do you think this is like a start of even more data that will be shared, you know, like across different governments around the world, even not just the US?
Sorry, was that directed at me? I was just looking up the articles and client-side scanning.
Yeah, to you and to anybody else who's across this, maybe Paul even.
I never viewed any of the data that was collected by government just held by one government. I think that this is typically shared information, at least among certain allies. So, I expect that would continue definitely an increase over time.
Yeah. So we touched on social media. I think the British and EU regulators are actually really frustrated by, you know, anti-competitive behavior, the spread of misinformation, disinformation, fake news, you know, as you would call it, or somebody would call it. And just on, you know, on a lot of different things in our lives, including things as serious as elections, and also privacy invading business models. So these have typically, obviously, you know, come to light in, you know, big tech social media, you know, whether it's Twitter, X, Google, whatsoever. So I know that, you know, Web3 has a few different decentralized social media platforms that's gaining quite a lot of speed, and also a lot of uptake in users. Can Web3 actually show the right path for the future on how, you know, social media can actually be managed well and used for the purpose that it was, and not, you know, cause all these issues with anti-competition, negative impact on, you know, on citizens and governments and netizens itself? Patrick, do you have any view on that?
Yes, I think, first of all, as Travis mentioned earlier in the call, I think it's intrinsic to the business model of Web2 companies to explore people's data in order to extract the maximum amount of value as possible, right? We've seen this in numerous scandals throughout the years, and that, you know, that's probably not going to change unless they change the business model and change governments, change legislation, and these companies start to get impacted on their bottom line. That's how they are going to change. But it's, you know, it's not easy because the power of these companies is really incredible. Google's parent company's market cap is 60% larger than the entire crypto market. So it's really an enormous display of power here and of inequality. So I think, you know, first of all, we have to seek this new crypto democracy where we build applications, you know, it's by the people, for the people, in this world where data is the new oil. And that could be done also through decentralized governance, data protection through smart privacy applications or programmable confidentiality. And then, you know, with that, we can form this new democratic state of the internet, following a new set of rules, I think, that are way more democratic than the current ones.
Jai, do you have anything to add to that? Like, can Web3 actually show the right path for the future? Or, is it a shared responsibility in terms of working with traditional businesses? Or is it actually maybe the privacy companies that can actually play a bigger role in this?
In shifting the business model, is the surveillance economics of the internet. Yes, absolutely. I mean, I think, like, you know, my God, that is like one of the most interesting promises of Web3, right? Is really to kind of not just address the technical layer, but also address the economic layer. And that's where so many things go wrong. So, you know, it's, for me, it's one of the kind of like biggest, I think the jury is still out on that one, because, you know, once you do introduce economic and especially financial dynamics into infrastructure, you see all kinds of interesting and difficult challenges that come along with it. And I think the crypto industry has been going through that crazy ride over the past many years. But I do still believe that there is, that this experiment is ongoing. It's very interesting to see whether we can succeed on a few wins. And for me, one of the most interesting wins is to transform the business model that is at the core of the internet right now, which is a damaging business model. It incentivizes the wrong kind of behavior. It incentivizes people to spy on one another. And that's what we want to transform, right? By creating a different set of incentives. So if we can, you know, make use of the incredible tools that Web3 has brought to the table, that includes economic tools, and actually use those to incentivize infrastructure operators and business providers, or service providers, online service providers, to actually contribute to privacy rather than eroding privacy, I think we've kind of really nailed it. So that to me is one of the very interesting aspects of being not just a privacy tech company, but specifically a Web3 privacy tech company.
That's a great take. All right. We're actually at the end of the hour. Just before I wrap up, I think, Paul, is there, if I recall correctly, there is a PGP event that's upcoming next week.
There is, yes. There's the PGP for Crypto Breakfast, which I would love for you all to join. You can join remotely, and I'll get a link that we can share to all who have participated here. But before we do wrap up, I just wanted to say that, you know, it's really interesting. A lot of the discussion today is about the differences between Web2 and Web3, and of course, you know, how privacy and encryption relates to that. But it occurs to me that what we really need is not just a global encryption day. We need a global encryption and decentralization day, because encryption, it just doesn't do it by itself, right? You have to have the combination of encryption and decentralization. And so what I've tried hard to do is to basically hijack Global Encryption Day for the cryptocurrency industry, because honestly, much of the Global Encryption Day is something that is promoted and pushed pretty strongly by some really big Web2 players. And I appreciate that very much. But I think we need to make this our own. And to make it our own, it's going to have to be something slightly different. It's going to have to be something that focuses not only on encryption, but decentralization, and really the heart of Web3. So thanks for doing this. I really, really appreciate everybody's efforts here.
I think this is a great challenge. I think that this is a great idea. And organizations like UPA, you know, like us, I think this is something that we can absolutely spearhead and also make a reality and make it a good series. The amount of people and community that's engaged with the UPA, just because we have that many projects, is just astounding. I'm pretty stoked to see, you know, like the tweet about this X space actually got a lot of engagement because everybody came together. Like I mentioned, the UPA is cross chain and cross stack, so this means that, you know, there's this holistic privacy protection that we all can actually provide to people around the world. And, you know, it's weird to talk about us as a us and them, but, you know, we're talking about ourselves, you know, our families and our friends, my mom, my dad as well. And I think this is something that we are all really aligned with. And, you know, the projects that's on this space today is just, you know, just a few of the projects as part of UPA. And I think everybody should look forward to what we will do once we actually get formally established and start doing a regular series of different advocacy events and actions. So I'm just going to wrap up here. I just want to thank everybody for joining. We have Jaya from NIM. We have Paul from ECC, Travis from Orchid, Stark from Mobile Coin, Meredith from Aztec, who's already logged off, Patrick from Oasis, and Carter from Secret. If anybody on this space have questions for any of the projects, feel free to actually put it in the comment on the thread, or just, you know, just for, give these projects a follow and just send them a message or comments. Any last words before I actually terminate this space? No? Great. All right. See you all on the Web3 space. Thanks, everybody. Have a great day.
Thank you, everyone.
Thank you, Candace.